ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 2nd of January. I'm Nick Grimm, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. At least 40 people have died in a fire at a New Year's Eve party in the Swiss Alps. Witnesses have told of dozens of people trapped in an enormous inferno, and it's believed several tourists are among the dead. Europe correspondent Cyan Valence reports from Kronz, Montana.
A night of celebration becomes a night of horror. Those screams are from people running away from La Constellation Bar, situated here in the upmarket ski resort town of Kronz, Montana. It was just after 1:30 in the morning local time when it was engulfed by fire. Revelers were trapped inside as the inferno tore through the building. One person who managed to escape told the BBC he thought he was about to die.
We were trapped. A lot of people were trapped. We couldn't see because of the smoke. We didn't know how we were going to get out. I was alone and didn't know how I could do it. But I managed to break a window and get out through the window.
Dominique Dubois was at a nearby bar when he saw the flames.
You could see the orange, yellow, red. Understandably, they don't want civilians getting in and involving and getting in the way. And many were able to help, carrying, I don't want to say corpses. I think everyone who was out and kind of reactive survived, but carrying bodies out of the fire.
Authorities say at least 40 people have died, but the full death toll hasn't been finalised. Up to 100 people are injured, many with severe burns. They're being treated in specialist intensive care units across Switzerland and in Italy. Here's Frederick Gisler, the Valais police commander, speaking about the enormous response effort by Swiss emergency services.
It is one of the most significant operations that has been implemented. We have mobilised almost the majority of the firefighting personnel from the entire region.
Swiss authorities believe many nationalities are represented among the dead, but determining identities of those who lost their lives may take weeks. Here's the Swiss president, Guy Parmelin, speaking from the scene earlier.
Our thoughts are with the families who are in anguish. Some still do not know whether their children have died. Some are in the hospital in difficult conditions.
The Department of Foreign Affairs says it's making urgent inquiries to determine whether any Australians have been impacted. Here in the Alps, locals are still in shock over what they saw, and many are worried they may know people who died inside, including Corinne, a Kronz, Montana local.
I know someone who might have been among the victims, and I can't reach her. I'm very worried. I'm going to try to contact other people who know this woman to see if she is still alive.
The cause of the blaze is still being investigated, but authorities say there's no evidence this was a deliberate attack. This is Cyan Valence in Kronz, Montana, reporting for AM.
New York City's first Muslim and South Asian mayor, Zoran Mamdani, has been officially sworn in at a small ceremony in the city. He's promising to make sweeping changes to America's most expensive city to live. Rachel Clayton has more from Washington. Rachel, tell us about the ceremony. What's been the reaction so far?
Good morning. Well, the ceremony swearing in Zoran Mamdani was very on brand. It occurred last night in a no-frills event at an abandoned underground subway station alongside about 20 people, close friends, family and colleagues of Mamdani. About 20 people were there, including his wife and his parents. And he was sworn in with his hand on two Qurans held by his wife. He is, of course, the youngest mayor in over a century now in New York City. He's the first New York City mayor born in Africa. He's the first with South Asian heritage. And he's the first Muslim mayor in New York City. So a lot of firsts, a lot of things he's ticked off already. There's been a lot of celebrations, a lot of cheering. So it's been a happy time for him as a new mayor of New York.
So what are his plans for New York City?
Yeah, so Mamdani really campaigned on a ticket of democratic socialism. Him being a millennial resonated with a lot of young voters in New York City. He also managed to gain a lot of popularity with New York's ethnic minorities, particularly those with Asian and Hispanic backgrounds. And he's campaigned on some pretty lofty goals. So the headline changes that he really wants to make are all around affordability. He wants to make childcare free for kids aged 0 to 5. He wants buses to all be free. He really wants to rapidly bring down the cost of living, including freezing rents. Those promises were very popular. He's a very popular man, but he will face a lot of challenges to get those changes through.
And of course, his ascension to New York's top job earned him a fair deal of criticism, but also praise from the US President Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was very interesting. There was before Mamdani got to the White House to meet with Trump, and we all saw those comments from Trump saying that he really loved Mamdani, and I think a lot of us were quite surprised by that. There were comments that he may not even show up just because they're at political loggerheads, really. They are completely different in the way that they want to sort of create changes to make America more affordable. It is interesting that both Donald Trump and Zoran Mamdani at the moment campaigning and sending a lot of political messages around affordability because it is such a huge issue. But it was smart. I think that Mamdani going to the Oval Office, standing beside Donald Trump and sort of making him look good, because Mamdani is very popular. We know Donald Trump likes to be popular. He likes to be liked. Bringing him on side is a smart move. He is going to need the support of a lot of people on the other side of the political aisle. It put him in a good position to have public support from Donald Trump.
Rachel Clayton reporting there from Washington. Protesters have shut down major cities in Iran for most of this week, angry about the state of the country's economy and alleged corruption and mismanagement from its theocratic government. The protests began when merchants in the capital Tehran shut their shops in response to a currency crash. The unrest has now spread to other cities, with people demanding Iran's leaders end the country's clerical rule and hold free elections. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Chanting, "The homeland won't be free until the clerics are dead," these university students join their voices to the people in the streets. Sparked by a sharp devaluation in the Iranian rial, merchants began protesting at the start of this week and were soon joined by other Iranians angry about rising prices. "We've disguised their voices and won't use the names of people we interviewed for their safety." This woman from Tehran says the population is desperate.
"These protests are a hunger revolution. People have been pushed to desperation. When you look into young people's faces, you see sadness and exhaustion. Even though they work and are educated, they can't afford a pair of trainers or replace a mobile phone. Everyone is hungry."
But many of the protesters want more than economic relief. Angry about extensive corruption and decades of alleged mismanagement, this man says Iranians want an entirely new system of government.
"This anger comes from the sense that the country has been abandoned. As if no one intends to stop the collapse, the instability, or the soaring prices. It feels like none of this matters to the ruling power, and no one is making an effort to even acknowledge the lower income groups who make up the majority of society."
The currency crash came after other crises weakened Iran's clerical regime. A massive water shortage in Tehran and the 12-day war with Israel in June, in which the Iranian military was comprehensively dominated by Israeli air power. Iran's government has acknowledged public anger about the economy and appointed a new central bank governor. But Holly Dargress, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute, says people's grievances go much deeper.
"Some people have described the situation with the clerical establishment as a situation of paralysis, or someone not being at the helm of power, that being the supreme leader, because we haven't seen them make any big moves to address these key issues that are upsetting Iranians."
Iran's security forces initially responded cautiously to the protests, but now appear to be increasing their repression, moving from firing tear gas and less lethal ammunition to shooting live rounds at some protesters. Holly Dargress says if oil workers strike, security personnel start defecting, or a critical mass of people join the protests, it could signal a major change is imminent.
I think that would really signal to the regime that something needs to be done, that people need to step down and let them, the people lead a different, and I would say a brighter future for the country.
That's Holly Dargress from the Washington Institute, ending that report from Eric Torchek. The holiday season and especially rough surf conditions have combined to exact a terrible drowning toll with a spate of deaths in New South Wales and now Queensland. A man and a woman have died on Sydney beaches while another woman died on the mid-north coast. Rescue teams are still searching for two others, including a 14-year-old boy. An Irishman has also drowned at a Whitsundays beach in Queensland. Angus Randall reports.
It should be one of the busiest times for Sydney's iconic beaches, but several remained closed yesterday after multiple drownings. CEO of Surf Life Saving New South Wales, Stephen Pearce, says many beaches are too hazardous to swim.
If you do not see a lifeguard standing on the beach, if you do not see those red and yellow flags, do not enter the water today.
It's still gusty along the Sydney coast. Locals at Maroubra Beach know to stay out of the water.
I think you should go and do something else, something away from the ocean. It's just too dangerous and it's too unpredictable.
If there's no flags on the beach, just don't ever go anywhere near it.
One of the drowning victims was a 25-year-old Chinese national who was hit by a wave and knocked into a tidal pool before being carried further out to sea. Figures from the Royal Life Saving Society show a third of all drowning victims over the past decade were born overseas. Melbourne Sikh community leader Harpreet Kandra established a swim program 2 years ago after four members of the local Indian community died at an unpatrolled beach. He says for a new arrival, swimming lessons can be a low priority.
They start trying to acquire an Australian accent, they start improving their English. They learn driving and start looking at the local driving rules and all. In the same way, I think they need to connect with water.
Professor Rob Brander is a beach safety researcher at UNSW. He says safety information is out there, but it can be hard to reach certain communities.
Some of this information is quite challenging and you can't go into too much complex details, but what we do need to tell people is some of the basics, as in, we've done studies that a lot of new migrants have never even heard of the red and yellow flags after living here for 5 years.
Last year's Royal Life Saving figures show more than a third of drownings happened at the beach or on the open ocean. 37% of beach drownings were linked to being caught in a rip. Professor Brander says with so many factors to consider at the beach, if in doubt, talk to a lifesaver.
You know, I've spent 10 years patrolling beaches and very few people would come up and ask anything. Some people would, but generally they don't. And that's a resource that could be tapped into.
It may seem intimidating to someone who hasn't grown up around the water. So Harpreet Kandra says any programs need to cover the benefits of swimming in the beach, not just the dangers.
When you start packaging the solution to the problem in a different package, people will start appreciating it.
Melbourne Sikh community leader Harpreet Kandra, Angus Randall reporting. An Australian woman is believed to become the first person in the world to donate organs after self-administering voluntary assisted dying medication. She shared her story with the ABC prior to her death last year, speaking frankly about how her choice would challenge accepted notions about organ donation. National Health Equity reporter Caitlin Gribben has this exclusive story.
Oh, the things that you do for poodles.
Flanked by her daughters and dogs, Karen Duncan is in her happy place. But there's sadness too. This is one of the last times they'll all be together.
I would like to take my leave before I get worse than what I am. It's not really what I call living.
At 55, Karen decided she wanted to die through voluntary assisted dying, or VAD. Speaking with the ABC before her death, she described the aggressive form of motor neuron disease that was robbing her of life.
It's not a very nice disease to have, so it was important for me, and dying with dignity is another thing.
But there was something else she desperately wanted, to donate her organs.
It's something that I'm passionate about. I think that if, you know, a family had needed it, I would hope that somebody would help my family.
Donating organs after assisted dying is a relatively new practice in Australia. According to state and territory health department data provided to the ABC, Victoria and Queensland are the only states to report a small number of organ donations after VAD. Combining two wishes, VAD and organ donation, is not straightforward, but Karen was determined.
If I'm in a position to help people, it's just a given.
Until now, all globally reported instances of organ donation after VAD have happened after the medication was given intravenously by a physician. But in Karen Duncan's home state of Victoria, VAD legislation requires individuals to swallow the life-ending substance themselves unless they are physically incapable. Karen Duncan told the ABC she was initially advised that self-administration of the medication would rule organ donation out. Dr. Rohit DeCosta is the medical director of Donate Life Victoria.
Karen challenged that assumption for us and said, no, well, why should that be the case? Can't we at least look into it? And we did, and found that it was possible for Karen, and looking through the data, we suspect it will be possible for others.
There are major ethical considerations around combining VAD and organ donation. Dominic Martin is a professor in health, ethics and professionalism at Deakin University.
Both of them are practices that require really serious attention to ethical safeguards to ensure that people are not being exploited or coerced.
Karen Duncan kept her spirits high until the very end.
Let me show you how to do it.
But she never lost sight of her goal.
I'm hoping to give the maximum amount of organs that I can. That'll be nice.
And daughter Brianna Cox says her mum did exactly that.
Really, really emotional, really proud. She's even bigger of a hero now. Just so grateful to have a mum like that.
That's Karen Duncan's daughter, Brianna Cox, ending that report from Caitlin Gribben. Standing in a row and following a choreographed sequence, it might not be everyone's idea of a workout routine, but line dancing has seen a big kick in popularity in recent years. And on top of the obvious physical benefits, boot scooters, as they're known, say the dance helps their mental well-being and can even stave off cognitive decline. Kimberly Price reports.
From the top, 6, 7, 8.
Stepping from side to side, front to back with a few hip swings and yee-haws, line dancing is going through something of a resurgence in dance clubs across the country. Emma has been boot scooting since April.
At first I was a bit hesitant because I'm not much of a dancer, but after the first session, we just got hooked.
James is another regular line dancer.
It's just a great way of releasing stress and any extra energy you've got in the evenings. It's really good.
Alice Glenn, who goes by Glenn when teaching, is the founder and co-facilitator of line dancing group Country Struts.
During lockdown, we started line dancing via Zoom and in parks just to stay connected and have a bit of fun.
From lockdown hoedowns with friends to filling Melbourne halls with hundreds of participants, Country Struts has seen a boom in participation in the past 2 years.
We have an extremely eclectic community who come to our classes. Lots of young 20-year-olds, big queer scene, but then there's also lots of ladies who come who are sort of post-60. We like to think of ourselves as we're just for everyone. Anyone who feels like dancing, coming and connecting with people, we're here for them.
Okay, so you're a rocket scientist. That don't impress me much.
Country Struts is not the only group seeing a rise in participation. Danielle Lerlagedeck is a senior lecturer in social science at CQ University.
There's definitely a rise in line dancing in Australia.
While there are physical and mental benefits with line dancing, Danielle Lerlagedeck says there are positive outcomes for older people in particular.
It increases things like flexibility, mobility, balance, and it's been used as a complementary treatment or therapy for people suffering from Alzheimer's and dementia.
Kate and Saray have been friends for many years and have just taken up line dancing.
It's just fun. I mean, it's good exercise, but you just laugh the entire time.
Remembering the steps cognitively, that feels like, oh, that's a good thing. You know, I don't do Sudoku, so I'll do line dancing
at
instead.
Our age, I think it's important. Yeah.
Line dancer Saray speaking there, ending that report by Kimberly Price. And that's AM for today. Thanks very much for your company. I'm Nick Grimm.